Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have a special guest, Dr. Peter Salerno. Dr. Salerno is a licensed psychotherapist, a clinical supervisor, and a trauma-informed educator who has authored 7 books. He specializes in treating trauma resulting from chronic manipulation by pathological personalities, with a particular focus on cluster B personalities. It's a level of diagnosis. Having survived such experiences himself, Dr. Salerno has dedicated his career to supporting victims and survivors of this unique and often misunderstood form of abuse. Through his clinical practice and consultations, he guides individuals on their journey towards understanding, survival, recovery, and healing. His mission is to help those affected by pathological relationship abuse to reclaim their personal power and rebuild their lives. You can find out more about Dr. Salerno's work at drpetersalerno.com. Here's Dr. Salerno now. It is a pleasure to have Dr. Peter Salerno with me today. It was my hope that you would be able to come on to the show. I've been watching your videos for a while, and I love your expertise, but I love also how you get into how other therapists and other professionals in this field are kind of missing the mark. And I want to get into that with you because I have felt in a similar way to you that there's this piece missing or the focus is on the wrong person. It's a pleasure to have you on, and welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'd love you to take a moment to introduce yourself and tell me and tell all of our listeners about you, but also what drew you to this as an area of specialization.
Yeah, so I'm licensed as a psychotherapist, and I was working with trauma survivors and PTSD for quite a while. And then my career kind of started to move into the direction of survivors of pathological relationship abuse. Individuals who have been in relationships with severe disordered personalities and helping them understand differences between like intentional abuse and more reactive mm-hmm. defensive strategies to cope that could mm-hmm. potentially be abusive but aren't necessarily vindictive in nature. And one of the reasons that my career took that turn is because I actually survived a relationship in my personal life with somebody that I would 100% deem a psychopath. So somebody who has no guilt, shame, or remorse, lacking in conscience, and very much enjoyed the manipulation, the exploitation, the conning, and zero regard for the consequences. And so the traditional interventions, history-oriented interventions, and attachment-based interventions that we typically use in therapy are not a one-size-fits-all, especially with a disordered personality. And so I had to teach myself how to relate to somebody who's intentionally abusive, and sort of let go of these preconceived notions that everybody's the same on the inside. Everyone has, you know, a wound that could be healed, and then they could become, you know, a productive member of society and interpersonal relating. And so through that journey, I started discovering research and trainings and perspectives of that kind of went against the grain related to personality pathology. There's some professionals and experts who absolutely have concluded that there are some individuals who exploit and manipulate and abuse on purpose, and they derive pleasure from it. And if we keep teaching clients and therapists that those people don't exist, there's going to be a lot of harm for clients who are trying to get out of really dangerous situations. So
That's yes, very powerfully said. It's interesting because people listening to the show have heard me talk a little bit about a past relationship that I was in, and that when I was already doing this work, I remember having these moments where I would tell a client something or suggest something and think, okay, I should probably be listening to that. Because it was exactly what I was coming home to, the fear of hearing, you know, the key turning in the door, not knowing what I was going to be faced with, what I was going to be blamed for, what all of it, and how my whole evening was going to then be taken up by needing to listen to someone go on and on and on until, and I was not going to have dinner. I was not going to get a bathroom break. And if I looked away for a moment, it was, well, you obviously don't care, but this was after the fifth hour of, you know, and also when I had young kids, there was a jealousy about, you know, about that, even about my pet, and abuse towards those things that I loved as being threats to, you know, someone's, me being able to be totally focused on that person. But here I am working with former cult members, and I was able to somehow compartmentalize it to the point where I didn't see myself in that until I suddenly did.
Right.
And it was really interesting when that transition happened. And so I'm very glad to hear that you are no longer in the trenches in that way, in this relationship that sounds like it was really horrific. But it is really an incredible thing, because I think we assume that what's true for us is true for other people. And if we have a certain personality where we might not even go into someone's house and open the fridge without asking,
right,
then who are these people who kind of roam the world with us, who have this sense that they can do anything at any time?
Yeah.
What is that about, and how does that get started? It's very interesting to me.
Yeah, it's interesting to me too. And in fact, I, you know, when we're taught in our degree programs what we're taught by who teaches us, and, you know, we typically have, I would say, since the beginning of mental health care as like a discipline or as like a field of science, there's been this high emphasis on environmental determinism, which is basically, we can make anybody into anything based on how we treat them early in life. And, you know, this may not be popular, but it's categorically untrue. You know, we all start off with startup material, you know, and we have differences in our DNA sequence, and we have these individual differences. And there are some people, like it or not, who are wired in such a way where their temperaments make them susceptible or vulnerable to exploiting environments rather than collaborating in them. And we see this in early childhood. It's not something that everybody likes to talk about, but it's in the research. You know, we see young children that some of them are a little bit more malicious, some of them play a little bit more violently, more harsh. And then when we study these children, when we study temperament, we study personality, like from a longitudinal perspective, where we're seeing them in certain stages and ages, and we're following them and doing follow-ups throughout the lifespan, and we're seeing there's some consistency in traits.
Mm-hmm.
We have to factor in that there might have been these this kind of encoded program that was gonna manifest itself regardless of the upbringing that a person has, because we see these individuals in warm, loving mm-hmm. upbringings, and we see them in very abusive upbringings. But it's interesting how, like, really regardless of the environment, there are some people who just exploit and abuse others across life, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's really incredible. You should mention it because it's reminding me of some work that I've done in schools, because I have a background in education and early childhood education. And so I've been a school counselor, and I was recently observing a four-year-old. She's in a classroom, and they're saying that she was having trouble relating to some of the kids. And she also pushed her way through the room physically, where she would just knock people out of her way. Really, like, and here, some of these are kids who are new to walking, so that she would just tip them right over, like, they had no sense of balance yet. So it was like a bowling ball, like, moving through the room. And they just didn't know what that was about. They kind of blamed it on the fact that she had a lot of older siblings, and maybe that's the way she made it through the house. But I watched a good 20 minutes, and it was fascinating to actually see her. I could see her being a cult leader. It was interesting. They were sitting on pillows in a circle in the room, and she had brought these little decals to put on nails, and kids were coming over because they wanted one. And the teacher was saying, now you need to make sure that you give everyone one. If you're going to bring something, you need to share it. Oh, sure, I'll share it. None were given out, but the kids needed to kind of fawn over her. If they fawned well enough, then they didn't get one, but they could sit closer to her. And then she had this other boy who was basically being like her bouncer, who knew that it would make her upset if anyone touched her. And so he was pushing people out of the way. Like, she had worked a whole community around her to please her, to keep her on an even keel, to keep her from losing her, because she did a couple of times, and it scared the kids. But they got into line, which was interesting.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And she worked a whole community around pleasing her, and had her, like, henchmen doing the bouncing. And these were four-year-olds.
I know. Yeah.
It was amazing to watch. And the teacher said, we just have to make sure that when she gives them out, that she gives them out to everyone equally. I said, she's not giving any out.
No, not even close.
She's going to go home with the same amount that she brought into school. But there's going to be a lot of discussion, and people are going to need to please her and prove something to her. Just watch, even for 5 minutes, just watch. And it was fascinating to see.
I am so relieved that you're bringing this up. I know it's a taboo topic when we talk about four-year-olds, right? But the truth is, we can diagnose personality disorders as early as age four. I mean, we can. Yeah.
Wow.
That's what the new recent research is saying. It's contrary to what a lot of people believe about personality, that because, personality, we think it develops over time. You have to be 18 in order to have a formal diagnosis. That's actually not true. But this cult mentality that you're describing, where people mm-hmm. are being groomed, conditioned, used, exploited, there's subterfuge, there's conning, there's entrancement. I mean, How did this person learn that from her parents within 4 years? I highly.
And she had convinced the teachers that she was doing something really kind, and that they were praising her, and she was taking it in and smiling. And then as soon as she turned back to these kids, she was tough. She lost her smile. She knew how to work the room. I mean, It was actually a little chilling.
Yes.
Because I thought, we're going to have to watch this kid.
Well, it's so important to get this information out, that it exists as possible, because I think people really have a hard time wrapping their minds around the idea that, we tend to think of children as passive recipients of their environment and not having minds of their own. And this is a clear example of a child who has a strong mind of their own and knows exactly how to get what they want, you know?
Yeah. And is very smart.
Yeah.
And it's a different way of using intelligence, I
correct.
Think, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then what do you do? Do you jump in to try to curtail her behavior, or do you jump in to try to do basically cult education and prevention to the other kids, you know?
Right.
Like, notice, don't listen to her words, but notice her actions.
Mm-hmm.
You keep needing to prove something or answering her questions about things or offering to give her part of your lunch. I mean, they were offering her lots of things. And she still didn't give them anything, but she did get their lunch. It was fascinating.
Yes.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So to go back to, wow. Yeah. This is very interesting. I hadn't even thought about that till that happened. That was just a few weeks ago. I would love to hear about this pathological relationship abuse and sort of being able to decipher when it's on purpose, when it's not, because there are even different kinds of cult leaders. Some who know from the start what they're doing,
right.
And others who it's more like a folie à deux, where they have this psychosis, they invite people into the psychosis, and there's some kind of innocence about it.
Yes.
Even though it can still wind up being dangerous, like with Heaven's Gate in San Diego, where they all died.
Yeah.
But I think the leaders really had a pathology, and they were trying to help people go to the mothership. I think there was an innocence about it.
Correct.
But with other cults and cult leaders, you don't see that. There's the nefariousness that is the chilling part.
Yeah. Well, I think to go back to your question about differentiating between pathological relationship abuse and non-pathological forms of abuse. So pathological relationship abuse, the reason why it's pathological is because it's operating in the context where somebody has an enduring pattern that's pervasive, that is consistent with their character. And it's not episodic, it's not symptomatic, it's not situational. This person goes about the world with certain traits that are pathological in nature. And so the abuse is intentional and it's offensive, meaning they're not compensating from some sort of inferiority complex. They're not defending themselves against these perceived fears or threats. They're actually enjoying being on the offense, because being offensive can result in getting what you want. You know, it can result in control. It can result in having your own distorted purposes and needs met. And so we talk about pathological relationship abuse in the context of someone who is capable of that is likely someone who has disorder in their personality. And so they have disorder in their entire operating system. What it means to be them as a person, there's a lot of distortions, deficiencies, and excesses that are not consistent with what we call normal, what's expected of us in our culture. So what that means is they feel like rules don't apply to them. They feel entitled. They feel like they are above everybody else, so that they're justifying these behaviors, they're justifying. And when you confront them about it, they don't see that the problem is originating in themselves. They externalize the blame.
Okay.
You compare that with non-pathological abuse, which means people can be abusive who are not disordered people. I mean, we're all capable of hurting someone else to a degree. The difference, what makes it non-pathological, is if we hurt somebody with our words, with our, you know, emotions, with our actions, we will have this ego dystonic experience, meaning it will feel foreign to us to be that way. Like, it'll feel like we're acting out of character, and it will feel like an affliction for us rather than something that we are enjoying or intentionally participating in, and that will motivate us to want to remove it. So, for example, in a family that yells a lot, maybe somebody grows up and thinks that the best way to solve problems is to scream at their partner. Well, if that partner tells that person, I don't really like the way you're talking to me. I didn't grow up in a household where we were allowed to scream at each other this way. It's disrespectful. I need you to stop. A non-pathological person might get temporarily defensive, but then they also might reflect and think, you know what? They have a point. This isn't problem solving. This isn't useful. And they can see that this behavior is not working for them or their partner, and they want to make arrangements, if you will, to modify that so that it doesn't happen again. And they have the capacity to make that change. That's non-pathological, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pathological would be that same scenario, but instead of the person reflecting and self-correcting, they're going to go, well, the only reason this is a problem is because you're making it a problem. And if you just stop bringing it up, then we don't have a problem. So it's really you that's right. causing this dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see how there's a difference in the way that it's perceived in a non-pathological brain versus a pathological. The pathological brain always is going to say, none of this is problematic until you bring it up, essentially. Right?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with me exploiting you until you complain about it, kind of a thing.
Right. Okay. So it's reminding me of my past relationship where I was always picking a fight.
Right. Right. Exactly. But you weren't. You were just, you were reasonably standing up for yourself and confronting things that were inappropriate. But in their eyes, there was no problem until you did that. And so.
Right.
The onus is on you to change. Stop bringing this up and then we'll get along better.
Right. Right. And okay, so then you add in kind of the perfect storm piece of this when you're in a cult, because then you're conditioned to not only think, but know that everything's your fault.
Yes.
So that's an automatic. I mean, the leader doesn't even have to say it.
Correct.
And then people who leave are still sure of it. It's very hard. It's also hard because while I think, you know, new age thinking, large group awareness training, you know, S landmark, all that. Yes, it's been helpful in some ways. The issue, and I actually run a support group for former instructors of landmark, which is interesting because they have a lot of moral injury from the things that they passed along to other people to do that turned out to not be at all helpful to them. But there is this, you can't make other people feel something thing, you know, that if you, and it only goes in one direction, that if I say something and it bothers you, that's on you. I can't make you feel that. I can't make you upset. People can't do that to each other. Although the leaders are usually very defensive and you can make them feel a lot of things. But then people are walking around even with this sort of, you know, new age thinking about it, that we are all somehow responsible for ourselves in this way. And, you know, so I think it really keeps people from being able to defend themselves, but even having clarity
in
that moment.
Yeah, there's this belief that gets in sort of implanted or installed that nobody can make you feel anything. You're responsible for. The reality is there's EEG recordings of brain activity that show that people can make other people feel.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, people can take good feelings out of you and people can put bad feelings into you if they're good enough, if they're good enough with the manipulation. So that's just not true that we're all responsible for every, you know, thought, feeling, and emotion that we experience. It's just not true.
Right.
People can condition us, groom us, brainwash us, all kinds of things. Now, cult leaders are exceptionally good at making people feel like if they're having a bad feeling or a negative problem or even a resistance to this idealized view where they got disillusioned, that's happening inside of them, and then that's something they need to work on and correct, versus it being that they are they're onto something, or they're listening to their intuition and something feels wrong, that gets immediately dismissed. And it's like, no, you are now on the outskirts because you've betrayed our ideology. You've betrayed yourself. You've betrayed, the group. You've betrayed me. I mean, there's so many ways that they can make anybody who starts to attempt to have clarity. There's so many ways that they can shut that down and pathologize it in a victim.
It's interesting you should mention that. I was one time kicked out of a cult. Oops. I went to an introductory meeting. I mean, if I can, if there are groups that people are letting me know about, and I can check it out myself, I'll go just to see if it's safe, if there aren't sort of locked doors. Just to be able to see what techniques of influence are being used. And so I went to a meeting, free introductory meeting of a group, where everything was talked about as being projection. So that if you think that someone has hurt you or whatever, that means that you have the desire to hurt them or to hurt other people. It's all a projection, which is highly head spinning. And like most things in cults or with these kinds of relationships that you talk about, it only really applies in one direction. So what happened was the instructor was telling everyone if they were disagreeing with what he was saying, that was a projection. And none of it came together. None of it made sense. It was all word salad, but whatever.
Yeah.
And so, but then he was very liberal with criticizing the people there as being closed-minded, as being unspiritual, as having so much room to, they needed to grow, they needed to be willing to do the hard work. So I just wrote down the things that he said to other people. And I said, so this projection idea, let me raise my hand nervously, this projection idea, does it apply to everyone? Yes, of course, I wouldn't be saying it if it didn't apply to everyone. Okay, great. So you said to this person this, is that a projection then on your part that you really feel this way? Ooh. And I just knew already I could see. And the people in the room, it was interesting. They got very anxious.
Oh, yeah.
And defensive on his behalf.
Yes.
Right. And so it was interesting to see the whole social psychological piece happening in play. And then I got kicked out.
Yeah, of course.
But I felt like it was important to do that, even though I don't like confrontation, but I like education.
Yes.
And I wanted to use that moment.
Just
collected my things.
What a wonderful example of how, there's a difference between, education and indoctrination, right? And so this individual was indoctrinating his people so that he's the exception to the rule. You all project, but I don't. I'm authentic. I'm clear. I'm, no projections over here. And you called him out, which probably enraged him. And then everybody else was in this state of terror because they somehow know without even having to be told, you don't enrage, you don't provoke.
Right.
The leader.
Wow.
I mean, what a powerful example of the control and the coercion and the, manipulation that can take place in that group.
And you can see it in politics now. I mean, you see it in a lot of places, right? It's very interesting. I'm wondering also about you noticing that some of the people out there, of course, you don't have to mention who they are, but just that there are a lot of people out there speaking about these subjects and that there is a sense that it kind of fits, but doesn't necessarily. And what are you noticing that you kind of were needing to really refine and help to define? Because I have that with people who are looking for like former cult member support groups. They'll go to a group that has to do with some form of abuse, or they're sent to anger management because they have a lot of anger about what happened, but they realize that's actually not it. So there's a lot of people out there who are looking for something, but it's not quite it. And so what were you noticing as you were seeing people out there, a lot of talking heads out there talking about this issue?
Well, again, I think if I'm answering your question correctly, I think people have been taught this false notion that if abuse is taking place, then the abuser themselves, they're an abuse victim. And so you need to see them with unconditional positive regard, with empathy, with understanding of what they've been through that led them to get to the point where they felt like they needed to abuse you or control you. And so there's what's missing is this acceptance of intentionality with cult leaders, with authoritarian leaders across the board, with institutions where there has to be a hierarchy and then there has to be one person or just a couple people calling the shots and everybody else has to just, you know, obey, essentially. These aren't structures that are designed for equality, and they're not going to be helped if we keep projecting, if you will, trauma and abuse onto the people who are organizing these things. I mean, this idea that people just don't know what they're doing all the time and they're constantly reacting to their own traumatic experiences is just not true.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are people who very much know how to work things in their favor, to their advantage. So I think what's been missing is helping people out of cults, helping people out of situations where they have become coerced into believing things that aren't true, that they've been abused. We've oftentimes taught them that you're just another version of the person who did the abusing. And I think we need to stop doing that. It's created measurable harm and invalidated so many victims, because what it tells the victim is, well, if that person who did all these things to me could just be where I am now, be in this therapy room or be here in this group, then they'll feel better too. It's just this weird, misguided, misdirected empathy and sympathy for the abuser rather than being able to focus on recovering from your own abuse.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's very interesting. I think if you find out that the person you're with, let's say, has been through abuse themselves and now they've become abusive in one way or another, it can be an explanation, but it's not an excuse.
Right.
It's not something that gives them a pass necessarily, or should. But yeah, you're right. There is this, well, let's understand this other person. And that's sometimes where the focus remains. And that really is a disservice. How interesting.
Also, trauma and abuse are not interchangeable terms. So there are people who experience abuse and are not traumatized by that. Not all of us are traumatized by the same things. I mean, trauma at best is a relative experience. It's you know, you and me could go to the same movie and we have two completely different experiences. And one could, you know, keep me up for a month and you could be leaving going like, what's the fuss about? I don't get it. Like, it wasn't that big of a deal. And that, I think, has to do partly with our innate temperament, more so than I would say our environmental experiences, but our environmental experiences can certainly contribute to our reaction to that.
Mm-hmm.
But so my point is, people who are psychopathic, who are narcissistic, they can experience what other people would experience as a severely traumatic incident. And for them, they could have indifference to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to rattle their nervous system the way it would rattle somebody who has more sensitivity or has a conscience or has, you know, empathy. Like, they're not going to feel guilt or shame about certain things that happened to them. What they might do is they might use it as an opportunity to retaliate, to justify retaliation. So just because somebody is abused, it does not automatically mean that they have developed trauma from that abuse. And especially we see this in disordered personalities like psychopaths and narcissists. They use abuse to their advantage. They use grief and loss to their advantage. I've seen narcissists gain sympathy by talking about how they're widowed, and they actually don't have any sadness related to being widowed, and they don't miss the person who died, but they know that socially most people are going to shower them with admiration and praise and love and comfort, because it's just assumed that everybody who's lost a loved one is going to be devastated. Mm-hmm. Guess what? Mm-hmm. That's not true. It's not true.
Wow. So let's talk about that kind of interesting bridge from narcissism to sociopathy. And I know there's going to be some overlap.
Yeah.
But the personality that doesn't mind, like sort of the Munchausen by proxy personality too, the person who doesn't mind someone else suffering.
Right.
They have a kind of a disconnection from someone else's pain.
Correct.
They get what they need, and there is this chilling aspect to their personality, especially if it's so different from your own.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the differences between those diagnoses.
Sure. So when we're talking about narcissism, the exclusive, or not the exclusive, the main trait of narcissism is typically grandiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Grandiosity encompasses self-centeredness, the tendency to be condescending toward others because you think you're superior, this really truly sincere belief that you're entitled to special treatment. It's not a compensation. It's a belief that they are better and they are entitled to special treatment. It's an arrogance that's not earned through activity or accomplishment. It's just expected that you know that they're better. They don't have to prove it. Just are expected to believe it. And then it also involves a lack of equality. So these people really see themselves as above everyone else. There is no equal, right? So that's that's grandiosity in a nutshell. I mean, there's a lot of factors to it. That's the primary trait of what we would refer to as a narcissistic personality or NPD, right? What's interesting about that is they are very capable of they do lack empathy, and so they're very capable of exploiting and harming other people for their own self-interests. But oftentimes with a narcissist, they get intellectually lazy with their exploitation. So they're most of the time opportunistic exploiting than preferential and to the point of like stalking or retaliation. Mm-hmm.
If you can describe, given the example of the opportunistic part.
If somebody comes their way, they decide it's their best, the narcissist decides it's in their best interest to pursue them. They want to exploit them. There's something from them that they want. Eventually, you go through this phase of they idealize them. Then they start to realize they're not perfect. So they start to devalue them. They start to demean them. They start to deny responsibility for the problems in the relationship. And then this inevitably results in a discard. But the discard could be very passive. It could just be like, you're no longer worth my time. I could do better. Okay. It's not across the board. There's a continuum of narcissistic pathology. So I don't want anyone that's listening to hear me say all narcissists are that way. I'm saying there's a lot of them that are that way, and that's where it stops, right?
Okay. Yeah, right.
Then we move into what you're calling sociopathy, okay?
Yeah.
These terms that have been used, sociopathy, psychopathy, antisocial personality, when we start to move into a narcissist who is moving into that realm, we'll start to see less of a passive callousness and more of an intentional, active vindictiveness and exploitation, where they're not expecting you to appease them. They're going to demand it with force of some kind. Physical force, emotional, psychological force, coercion, subterfuge, something where now it's like, I'm not just expecting you to see how great and superior I am. I'm going to demand it. And if you defy me, I'm going to become very sadistic, very vindictive. Yeah. There will be revenge. There will be retaliation. There will be a punishment if I'm going to show you, essentially, versus you just need to know this. Okay. So it goes into this realm of pretty like malignant, dark intentions, where they actually derive pleasure from showing you that they are superior, better, whatever. And there's a complete dehumanization process. There's a complete disregard for consequences, for the feelings and needs of others, that's very active in nature versus that more passive, oh, you don't know how great I am, so I'm going to discard you type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, even as you talk about it, I think, oh, you know, like,
yeah,
I feel like I want to take a shower. Like, it's just,
yeah,
so
it's disturbing. It's disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is disturbing. And I think about people who are in situations where people are vulnerable. I think about in some of these places that have been talked about in the news, some of these teen treatment places, some of these residential places. I mean, really taking advantage and showing sadism. And in some of these organizations where people are abused or they're kept from medical treatment and they just watch people wither away.
Mm-hmm.
And that if they're told to go off their cancer treatment or a child is not given insulin, which recently happened in a particular cult group, and the people praying around them where the prayers aren't working, the leader doesn't mind blaming the parents for not praying hard enough, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
And so those are the stories that I hear. And so that's why I'm asking about this personality and where that personality comes from. I know that human beings are all different. So there isn't one answer to that. But what have you seen when you go into that realm?
Well, first of all, it breaks my heart to hear that someone is deprived of something they need and then it's blamed on something that is completely unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's horrific. I mean, to me, that's lack of conscience on the part of the person who's blaming.
Mm-hmm.
You're not praying enough when you actually know the solution. I mean, that's torture.
Right. It is. Yes, absolutely.
So
right.
that just breaks my heart. I've heard those, you know, those stories told in my own practice, people who've survived things. And I've heard it told to me by individuals who have actually are the ones who are the perpetrators too. And I see how they can tell a story like that with a smile on their face and just no clue that this is something that's supposed to be disturbing, right?
Right.
So there are individual differences. We're all to a degree different. However, for thousands of years, in every culture, in every society, in every historical period, in every social class, we've identified traits of humanity, human traits, right? Psychological traits, personality traits that have been consistent for thousands and thousands of years and well documented and written down that describe types of people. Before there was mental health care, before there was a system, a classification system officially, people have been talking about these same individuals in an uncannily, like eerily similar way for at least 5,000 years. And there's been books written about character flaws and the way people are, regardless of the environment, that are so similar to the personality pathology we describe now in diagnostic manuals that, there's individual differences in people, but then there's people who've always existed who have been counterculture, if you will.
Yeah.
They've been not in a good way of trying to affect good positive change, in the way of like, the rules don't apply to me. I get to take what I want. I get to hurt people how I want. I derive pleasure from the pain I see in other people. Torture turns me on. I mean, really sadistic things.
Mm-hmm.
And so while everybody is different and maybe the manifestation of it looks a little different from cult leader to cult leader or serial killer to serial killer or narcissist to narcissist in domestic environments, for the most part, these people have similar traits.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just expressed a little bit differently based probably on their own personal preferences or life experiences or whatever. But these traits are what we really need to look into, you know?
Yeah. And I don't know, you know, when you also have God in the mix, if you feel like this is, you know, you're anointed by God or you're following God's wishes, then there's also this kind of emotional disconnection, kind of a floating, like when I've met a couple of cult leaders, they walk like their feet aren't quite touching the ground. And they don't have wrinkles. I've noticed like they're just not affected by anything around them. They don't have worry lines that, you know, that, right. I mean, not that I notice those things per se, but I often think they're younger than they really are.
Yeah.
Because things don't bother them. And, and that's fascinating to me.
And they've done studies on that stress immunity.
Oh, interesting.
Stress immunity is highly common in psychopathic individuals, or what you're calling sociopathic and narcissists. There's a lack of, they don't get worked up enough. And they've actually done tests where they've tested the, through secretions, levels of cortisol, levels of stress in their biochemistry, and they're seriously lacking in that. I mean, there's lower levels of that in these individuals. So they have this kind of stress immunity, which is a problematic for two reasons. One, they don't get anxiety when they're hurting other people. Mm-hmm. And two, they don't learn from consequences because they truly don't, like you said, they don't have those stress wrinkles. They don't have the, they don't have the reaction to novel stimuli that's supposed to scare them, or to, you know, hurting and torturing people that's supposed to evoke a reaction of concern or empathy. It just never comes online. There's no like internal brake pedal where they go, oh, okay, I've crossed the line. It actually turns, it activates them even more because they're not deriving any stress or anxiety provoking result from their actions.
So even the question sort of, how do you sleep at night after you've done this? Well, great.
They don't.
Actually, 8 hours. Thank you for asking.
That question might even confuse them. Like, what do you mean?
Right. Oh, that's so fascinating. Right. So sociopathy, psychopathy. I mean, yeah. So sometimes these words are used interchangeably, even though they're slightly different. But I see what you're talking about this stress immunity, which is a fascinating term. And it explains so much. It also explains, I think, why so many of these people feel they're above the law. And sometimes they are. I mean, our legal system doesn't protect people, really, almost ever. Nope. Nearly as well as it should. And so they have gotten away with a lot of things, which just makes it 10 times worse.
Yeah. This is also why it takes them longer to get caught, because we usually will get caught because our anxiety trips us up, right?
Yeah.
And then we're going to leave a trail, or we're going to fess up or confess. We can't take it. These people don't, those mechanisms don't activate in them. So it's easy for them to get away with things, and they can walk away from the scene of a crime, or they can, you know, go into public as a cult leader and not fear that they're going to be found out. One, it's arrogance. It's the grandiosity. It's I'm above the law. Two, it's they don't have that stress immunity. So when you experience them, you don't see them as somebody who is nervous. You see them as who has nothing to hide. They're cool and calculated, cool as a cucumber. And it's not because anything other than physiologically, their operating system is different. They have low levels of excitement, stimulation. I mean, it takes a lot for them to feel stimulation and excitement, which is why they typically do very impulsive, risk-taking, extreme things for personal gratification.
Mm-hmm.
So these people are not, I mean, they look like everybody else, but their system inside is not functioning in the same way as people who typically have anxiety and stress and a conscience.
That's so interesting. And so then, because of that, you can't really appeal to their conscience.
Correct.
So the only thing that might stop them is putting them away, like, you know, Keith Raniere from Nexium, who's in jail.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he still has followers. I'm sure he's still running. I mean, you know, a lot of cult leaders were running their group still from jail. A lot of people who were mafia dons still running,
yes,
you know, from jail. So nothing really, really stops them. But mm-hmm. it's an interesting thing because then sometimes the partners of or family of want them to get some kind of therapy. And I'm curious about that with you, because there are times that I've seen in my office or even now on Zoom that someone is bringing their, either one of them is sort of either the narcissistic partner. And I'm thinking, but I'm happy to meet with them as much as I, you know,
right.
I mean, if something happens that really makes me uncomfortable, and it did happen actually once not too long ago where a couple came in and he put his arm around her shoulder sitting on the couch, actually right behind me, but his hand came up to her neck.
Oh, geez.
And he was squeezing like a boa constrictor, kind of squeezing, and she was trying to kind of pull away, and I thought, no, I can't. Mm-hmm. This is actually not okay. And I made mention of it, and I asked them to sit on separate couches.
Yeah, good.
And also that she would look at him before she answered any questions. Oh. She had to get the approval, and I said, just look at me. I mean, I was sort of seeing the control, but he was trying to seem like a good guy being open to therapy, but it really wasn't going to be an open conversation at all. And I was actually worried about her safety after.
Right.
What has happened in your practice? Because I'm sure it happens with your area of specialization that you're faced with trying to do therapy with personalities like this.
Well, so a couple of things. I don't, if somebody first approaches me individually, and again, here's one of those taboo topics. Can we diagnose somebody who's not in the room? We don't need to diagnose somebody on an official medical record and who's not in the room in order to determine whether or not they have an enduring pattern of pervasive maladaptive behaviors that can be tracked across their lifespan. Nobody needs to be a professional to recognize an enduring pattern of pervasive maladaptive behavior across lifespan. You don't need to be an expert. You can just observe it and you see. Does this kid lie every time he's in the room? Yes. Does this kid lie at school? Does this kid lie to his parents? Does this kid lie to his siblings? Does this kid lie to his friends? Does this kid lose friends frequently because he can't lose in a board game or a video game? I mean, you don't need to be an expert to see that kid. He's got some pervasive pattern in his personality where he's combative. Mm-hmm. He's not collaborative. And it's inappropriate, right? So.
Right.
I want to say that for if any therapists are listening, you don't have to worry about someone providing you a key informant, providing you with information that resonates, and you go down your list in your head and you go, wow, that sounds a lot like that. You don't have to worry about, oh, I can't say anything because it's gonna be like I'm diagnosing someone that I'm not treating. If the person provides you enough information of an enduring pattern, it's okay to say, that sounds like something that we call this, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not on paper, not officially, but you're describing, based on what you've just given me, somebody who fits the bill for what we call, if it walks, talks like a duck, you know,
right,
kind of a thing. So I just wanted to say that. But I would never invite a partner into an individual dynamic if I received information from the individual that even, you know, I have reasonable suspicion that this person might have a personality disorder. I will never say, well, bring them in and we'll talk as a couple, or bring them in and we'll talk as a family. If it happens that a couple shows up, which if they show up together, they fill out their intake paperwork, there's no way that I could know if one of them is a narcissist or whatever at that. But if I start to get the hint, like you said, if I start to see that he's got his arm around her neck on the couch and she's looking at him every time before she responds to me, I would actually say couple therapy is not indicated at this juncture. Mm-hmm. I think there needs to be some individual work, because couples therapy can make an offender a more skilled offender. It can give them ammunition. It can give them new language to justify their behaviors.
Wow.
I would never suggest that if somebody is suspected of having a personality disorder, that there should be couple or family therapy with that person, because disordered personalities don't collaborate in treatment.
So they're not looking
to solve problems in treatment. They're looking to figure out how they can pin problems on the innocent party. So I have encountered that where I've had to tell people, hey, I don't think seeing you as a couple is indicated at this point. I think some individual work might be more useful at this point. I've had requests from individuals, should I bring my partner in? And I would say, based on what you've told me, I don't think that would be, you know, the best route right now. I've had individuals come in with letters from their partner because they had to find a way to get into the room. And so they wrote a letter. Mm-hmm. And my partner wanted me to read you this letter. They feel like they're being left out of the pro. I'm like, dude, okay. They're not invited in this room. Rip that letter up. But that's another coercive way to try to infiltrate. You know, they're feeling threatened that they're not in the conversation, so they're gonna find a way to get inserted into the dynamic by writing a letter. To me, that's super manipulative. So to answer your question, like I've seen so many variations of the perpetrator trying to get in the mix. And I've shut that down immediately. But then I've also seen them already in the mix because they show up as a couple. And then I've had to inform them both. I think at this point, meeting with you together is probably not going to be beneficial for either of you.
Mm-hmm.
And then the invitation, the request for an invitation to invite somebody else in once it's been determined that it's abusive is just always a simple no. That's not
right.
We're not going to bring them in. So
I mean, I feel like now this is sort of clinical supervision. How do you handle when then it becomes that you are then taking someone's side? That happens a lot, I've noticed, in these kinds of dyads, that if I don't want to necessarily meet with them together, or I feel like it's really not fruitful, that it's then seen that I'm taking someone else's side. Mm-hmm. Even if I ask, I mean, you know, when people, and I know I just asked you a question, but just to dovetail onto this for just a moment, when I'm running a former cult member support group, I'm very careful. If there are people who don't know each other, that they take a moment to introduce themselves and share what they're comfortable sharing at that time. But they're sensitive to who I call on and who I call on next. And I know a lot of them are not going to volunteer to go next because they're afraid from their cult experience of taking or from being with a controlling partner that they're taking up someone else's time or that they must think that their issue is more important. And then they have imposter syndrome. It causes a lot of things. So I have said that I'm happy to call on people, but I will call on them based on their name on my screen or just the order that they sat in if they're in my office.
Yeah.
But still, you must like that person more. And so they're kind of conditioned to do that comparative thing. But sometimes I think when people are with controllers, they will try to find anything to kind of make you wrong, that to find an excuse why this isn't going to work and why you're not going to be an objective person in their life and you've already taken a side. So how do you deal with that?
So you're talking about just victims only who are feeling like...
Victims, and then also the controlling partner who will notice if they'll sometimes say, I notice you smiled at my partner and not at me. That just seems to come up in these situations a lot.
If it's been determined that there's a partner with a disordered personality, you have to expect that they will feel like you're going to align with the person.
Mm.
I mean, oftentimes, even when you align with them, they'll still see it as a slight in some way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing.
Right.
There's nothing to validate or confirm with them because in their mind, you got to remember too, disordered personalities have a disordered lens through which they perceive things. So even if you tell them everything they want to hear, they still might have a problem with you. Like it's not, it's really not normal. So they're not, they're not going to get that. Oh, okay. I see. I see that you validated me, and I see that you want to validate them now.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing you could do to appease them or accommodate them in a way where they're going to be satisfied. So to me, that's just futile.
Right.
But if you're talking about a group situation where people have been conditioned to be pinned against one another, mm-hmm. or rivals or mm-hmm. threatened by one another, that I think, I can't speak to that like officially because I don't do that type of work. But I mean, I would say there needs to be a discussion that maybe like some agreements prior to group that like that's not how I operate. And if it comes mm-hmm. up and it's a sensitive thing, then, you know, we're going to have to process that in the here and now just to, mm-hmm. to move that out of the way in order to, because I could see how people would feel, you know, the lingering effect of a cult where they're going to feel like, oh, you're talking to them now and not me, or you gave them two more minutes and not me.
Right.
And they're fighting for justice and safety and all that. There's a really good, I don't know if you've ever heard of mentalization based treatment. That's something to look into because it helps people really see their own experience their own internal states and the states of others based on the situation in a more practical, accurate way.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who have trouble because their perception has been distorted, this mentalizing based technique has actually been very useful for them.
And it's
conducted in group set. I mean, it's a therapy that is done in group settings as well for mm-hmm. that very reason.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to check it out. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really helpful. I mean, I feel bad. I mean, with people mm-hmm. who then have to worry about this because they came from a situation where they really did have to worry about it.
Yeah.
And that you could lose all your standing and all of your hard work, as you know, like with these personalities, it, you know, you don't accrue points.
Right.
No matter how many sacrifices you've made or how many years or whatever else, you can lose it in an instant. It's like sort of mm-hmm. emotional game of chutes and ladders. Like you just
yes.
go right back to the bottom. So they come from this, they have this worry from an honest place, like they've dealt with it. Really, you've been here for 10 years, you've left your family, you've left everything, but you came 1 second late to this meeting where I was going to talk for 7 hours. So you now have to go clean all the toilets for years, you know. So they have the nervousness on purpose. You know, they've been conditioned and it's survival.
Yes.
And so it's hard, but I really want to help undo that. I think something else that I wanted to ask you about was this idea that a lot of people who I work with feel that they're making too much of their situation, their complaints. They do have this sense that they're being overly dramatic, you know, because they've been told all of that. And so for them to even just give their issues credence is a really hard sell. And so I'm just wondering about that piece, because there really is this sense that they are,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're faking it. And they're doing
right.
it for attention.
Right. Oh, my goodness. That's just so hard to hear. But they've been conditioned to minimize.
Mm-hmm.
No one, like other people have it worse than you. I mean, this is not something that you should get all worked up about. It's your internal sensitivity. It's your, you know, they pathologize the victim, essentially. As far as interventions for that, you know, you can, I've noticed that what helps sometimes is people will make an exception for a friend or a loved one who would say that, and they'll go, well, mm-hmm. of course they're not exaggerating or embellishing. Like what happened to them was horrible. They can't mm-hmm. really, they make themselves the exception.
Mm-hmm.
So I have people engage in activities sometimes where, like, what would you tell 20 things list that you would tell a friend of what kind of relationship they deserve, or if they've been through what if they told you those things, how would you respond to them? Would you say that they're dramatic and exaggerating? It's sometimes like one degree of separation away can help them get clarity that, well, if this happened to anyone I cared about, I'd be, you know, singing a different tune. I would be very upset. So there's some just sort of perceptual techniques that you can use to help them kind of realize that they're making themselves the exception, or they're minimizing. I mean, they're not, it's not a one size fits all, but that's sometimes effective. But really, this is a reality testing issue because their reality has been compromised. So they need to be in a group of people who validate, no, what you're saying is not an embellishment, not an exaggeration. Listen to me and me and me and me and me when I hear, when you and hear us say, what you've been through was not normal and it was very, very traumatic. I mean, you need to hear voices from people who are, you know, more objective, I guess.
I think. Right. Right. Something that's interesting that happens when people have been conditioned in this way to really doubt themselves or blame themselves. I notice that there is this delay between sentences when they're sharing their story. And so sometimes people who are not used to that, or therapists who I'm training to do these kinds of work, do this kind of work, will say, oh, I think she turned her mic off. And no, she's probably, or he's probably going through.
Yeah.
Thousand questions and doubts, and is it worth it? Am I taking up someone else's time? Is someone going to get upset? Is the leader going to psychically know that I'm talking about him and then I'm going to get punished?
Yes.
There are some people who were told that something bad would happen to them if they shared the secrets, or that something bad would happen to the person you told it to. So people on this podcast know that I sometimes with clients, I've needed to call them to let them know I got home safely after they told me their story, just so they could feel rest assured that that psychic power doesn't necessarily exist. And that they then, that was just a means of them keeping the person's secrets, secret. But that there's so many questions, and the imposter syndrome, and am I making this up? And so to cut through all of the self-talk is a very hard thing to do. And it is sometimes a lifelong challenge for some people who have really been conditioned, especially those who were born and raised in groups where they haven't had this elsewhere. So when you see people doubting themselves in this way, where they're almost so halting in the way that they speak, I'm wondering about those moments. Like, what would you think?
Yeah, I've heard that often with people. In these situations, or even a cult of one, like their mother was just somebody, you know, and so, and they get so ashamed and embarrassed sometimes too in the session, like they don't understand why they can't just put words to their thoughts, why there's a delay, and then it becomes, I'm sorry, I'm wasting your time, or I don't know why I can't just say what I want to say, or you see the terror, like this, it's like a psychomotor immobilization, like there's this paralysis in their body. And then there's also just like this feeling, you can see it in their face where you know, sometimes it's dissociation. Sometimes it's this delay because you weren't allowed to say anything. And they're like really, like you said, they're really going through all of the scenarios that could possibly happen if they vocalize this, that could go wrong. You know, I don't like, is this going to change the way you think of me? Is this going to change, you know, it's almost like they're the cult leader or their malignant parent or whomever is right there in the room with them at that moment. And they're like waiting. Am I like, can I really say this to you? So honestly, I've worked with people who 6-7 years, they still every once in a while have that moment of pause, and I don't force it. I don't say, hey, what's going on? Or, hey, what's on your mind? Or, hey. Like, and, you know, where'd you go? Like, I know, I just wait and I validate for the millionth time that it's okay to have that going on with you based on what you've been through. And nobody's brain that's been through what you've been through in their nervous system can just come up with things and just, you know, spit them out. So it could potentially be, in the context of like a therapeutic relationship, a lifelong consistent validation that that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily always a desire to try to change it or cure it or make it better. That might just be a lingering side effect that, you know, maybe some people work through and some people don't. But the best, I think the most important thing is to get to a point where when someone experiences that, they can self-normalize and go, I know why this is happening. I know why it's so hard to say this right now. I know why my body feels stiff right now. It's because of what I went through. So it's not always about curing these symptoms, because this is, I mean, we're talking about things that just should never happen. Our bodies weren't designed for them to happen. Our brains weren't designed for, you know. So, I mean, I to answer your question, long-winded, I've seen it, and I don't always think we got to put a stop to this. I think maybe we just meet them where they're at each time, and each time they know it's okay to tell me that that's what they, you know. Maybe it takes them 2 hours, and later they message me, email me, or text me and say, hey, I felt like I couldn't say, and I go, I know, like, and that's okay. Like, it's okay to not be able to say things once in a while. I mean, based on what you've been through, you know?
I like that. I like just having them put words to it and describe what's going on, and to normalize something that really isn't, as you say, normal, like it shouldn't have happened. I really love that perspective, that this is outside what our minds and our bodies are used to and, evolutionarily speaking, conditioned for.
Absolutely.
Wow.
We're evolutionarily conditioned to perceive threats that are not personal. You know, so there's this book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And essentially it's because after they almost get eaten, they don't take it personally. It's their natural habitat. Their system, their DNA, everything is designed to anticipate that, survive it, recover from it, and on. But when it's personal, like when we feel like we've been personally violated or attacked, or we've been told that it's personal, that there's something in us that's defective and that's why this happened to us, our nervous systems aren't designed for that.
That's so interesting. Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that. I mean, I get an ulcer watching nature shows with zebras being chased.
Yeah, I can't watch that stuff.
I can't. I'm one of those people. I've seen that meme of, you know, I can watch like a slasher film, but yes, if the dog dies,
Same here. Same here.
Okay. So I know we're coming to the end of our time, and I wanted to be able to get a little bit more into the traumatic cognitive dissonance and anything else that you want to make sure to mention. But just that I think people listening to this show are going, as you go through sort of the examples of that, even though we've already touched on some of them, they're going to see themselves in that picture, in that whole symptom picture. So I'd love you to just get into that a little bit more before we finish up.
Yeah. So, I mean, traumatic cognitive dissonance, to me, I define it as the result of chronic, covert and subtle, like manipulation, coercion, to the point where you don't know what's wrong inside of you. And then you don't know why you don't know what's wrong. And then sadly, you blame yourself for not knowing why you don't know what's wrong. And so basically your reality has been questioned and distorted and manipulated so many times that you can't land on, discursive thoughts or these ping-ponging thoughts in your mind, like, no, I know this person hurt me. Wait, well, maybe I'm overly sensitive. Maybe I'm exaggerating. And your mind can't really land on one of those. So it creates this mental haziness, this sort of fog, this consistent like ambiguity. And if you're in a state of ambiguity in a relationship like this, then the person who's put you in that state of ambiguity is 100% still in control. It's they bank on you not knowing whether or not they're abusive or not, whether or not they're controlling or not. That's what it really comes down to. So if you can't land on one side, they are or they aren't, that's what really causes the cognitive dissonance. And that leads to all kinds of psychological and physiological symptoms that are typically related to like a freeze response or this immobilization. It's an emotional, physical paralysis of sorts. Self-blame, loss of self-esteem, loss of self-worth. Sometimes it actually will lead, because of the fatigue element, can lead to thoughts of maybe I'd be better off dead. I mean, so it really gets extreme and severe. Not better off dead from like a depressive perspective or a wanting to die, but just like, if it's going to be this way forever,
right,
I don't know how much longer I can go on, kind of a thing. So this untreated and invalidated can become exceedingly dangerous for victims.
Right. And so I wonder what you think helps when, you know, I mean, when I work with people, I try to do a lot of cult education so people understand why they were taught these things and how it served the controller, how it served the leader, how it really wasn't a message about them.
Yeah.
And that does help at times, that to know that they were caught up in a well-oiled machine, basically.
Yeah.
That felt personal, but it had nothing to do with them. They were just caught in the vortex of someone else's issues and need to control, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, well, cognitive behavioral work, and I think a lot of just understanding the human experience, the existential piece of it. But I'm wondering, when you're dealing with this, and what are some good ways to respond?
Yeah, great. I think the psychoeducation component, that piece that you mentioned, is crucial first step. The knowledge is power. Like, they need to know that this isn't something that happened because of me. This is something that happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so to normalize that and say, this person was doing this to you and then everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And look how it's not personal. Look how, like, you know, you're not the only one. You're not the only target. So really making it like the perpetrator's problem, that they are a perpetrator, they're a predator, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think every nervous system is a little bit different. So different interventions, I think, need to be tested to see what would be most effective. So I've had a lot of success with EMDR therapy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new therapy out that's kind of, promising to be even quicker and less invasive than that, called accelerated resolution therapy. It's kind of like a spin-off from EMDR. Those two therapies have been very effective in getting people unstuck. And then cognitive behavioral therapy, attachment-based therapies are helpful. Creating that corrective emotional experience with a safe, trusted other individual. I think those things, we don't all have the same emotional experiences or nervous system. So unfortunately, it is sort of like, we got to try a few things out to see what's best for each individual. But there's definitely promising and very effective interventions for this population, people who've been victimized in cults. So I would encourage people to find a therapist they trust and feel safe with, or a professional coach, anybody, and then start to talk about options of, like, how best will my nervous system and my core belief system get on board with an intervention, you know?
Right. Right. I like the idea of finding a therapist you trust and to not settle, and to know that you are going to be really interviewing the therapist. They're working for you.
Yes, they are working for you. I would avoid therapists. I don't mean anything disparaging about therapists who do this because they've been taught this way. But when we're talking about pathological relationship abuse, cult survival, I would stay away from your own attachment styles. Okay, so if a therapist brings up your own attachment history, a therapist goes down memory lane and brings up your own parenting experiences with your parents, if they try to assess you for how empathic you are, if they try to assess for how codependent you are, if they try to assume that there are aspects of your own personality that made you gravitate towards this cult and you need to work on those. Those are red flags. Those are not relevant to this type of trauma recovery. And they could invalidate somebody so badly that they give up hope. So
I love it. Right. Putting the onus, the responsibility, the focus on the wrong person. Like, all the people who were asked the question, why did you stay? Okay, fine. We can talk about that. But really, that's okay. Stop that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, but I love that. I love that because that does happen. And also when therapists are not schooled in this or learning or knowing about narcissism, really, or knowing about cults and influence and coercive control, they will go back to the things they learned in school. And you will be talking about, like, if it's not one thing, it's your mother, right? Kind of like,
right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, endlessly. Which has happened, where people have spent 5 years talking about their mother, and that was not the issue.
Correct.
But because they had become people pleasers, they felt like they had to do that.
Yes.
There are two words also that I kind of caution people against if they're meeting with a therapist. And it doesn't mean you have to leave, but you want to bring it up if you can and see how the therapist responds to it. I think to not be working with a therapist who accuses you of withholding and accuses you of being resistant.
Oh, man. Yeah.
So I just say ahead of time when I'm talking to people, I'm never going to use those words. I think actually if I use them, it's the next time you feel you have to explain yourself to your controller, you can actually be resistant and withhold. But I'm not going to accuse you of that because you're setting boundaries and that's okay with me and I'll support that. Or I haven't made you feel safe enough yet to, like, what can I learn from you not wanting to share? I don't want to blame you, you know?
Yeah, no, it's not always this unconscious resistance or withholding and these, and that's not really always the case. And you mentioned boundaries and that's another, I think that I would caution people, if a therapist tries to pathologize your boundary setting ability, look, we only have boundaries because there are people out there who violate boundaries. We don't need to work on our boundaries. There's a reason why we have locks on our doors. It's because some people don't get the hint that they're not welcome into a place where there's a barrier. That doesn't mean that if our door lock breaks that we didn't protect ourselves enough. It means that somebody out there decided that they were entitled to violate the boundary. So I'm not a big fan of, we need to get you to have firmer boundaries, because if people would just respect each other, we wouldn't need them in the first place. You know?
I love that. Yeah.
So I just don't like it when people feel like now I have to do all this work on trying to become a more confrontive, you know, firm person in my life because I was in a cult. Like, what a horrible thing to have to put on someone after such an ordeal.
Oh, that's such a good insight. I love that. So thank you. Thank you. And where can people find your work, your books, all of that? Yeah, go
for it. So my book, my website is drpetersalerno.com, and then my social media handle is, I'm on Instagram at drpetersalerno, and then on both of those platforms, I have links to my books on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but you can look me up on Amazon if you want to, or Audible if you want to check out some of my books.
I'd love that. Okay. It was a total treat. Thank you so much for your time today. It was great to talk with you, to learn from you, to have really, I think, important discussions and new ways also for me to conceptualize some things that I've been working and dealing with for many years. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, me too. I learned a lot from you as well. I mean, this was a great, great conversation. So thank you.
Thank you. One more thing before you go. It is so exciting to speak to a fellow practitioner and someone who has studied so much in this field, and also someone who has been through these experiences personally in a similar way to my experience. And while I wouldn't wish it on anyone, it does sort of come through in people's work when they have felt it, really felt it themselves. There is a certain kind of sensitivity and sensibility that just, you know, just permeates, I think, someone's ability to show that they really get it. There are so many things also that I wrote down, and I love after I've talked to someone when I've just taken so many notes because there's been so much that I've wanted to remember that they said. One of the things that Peter talked about was this focus on the victim, the why did you stay question. And it is such an unfair question. I think people can ask it if they're in a therapeutic environment and to help someone understand what the forces were around them that made them feel potentially like they had to stay or they didn't have a choice but to stay. But the general public asks that of people randomly and often. Well, if it was really so bad, why did you stay? And there is a talk that I gave at a National Association for Social Workers conference. And this was about a year and a half ago. And they asked me to speak on this subject and a couple other subjects. And I remember going through a list of the reasons that people stay. And then at the end, kind of hit them with a surprise, which was after these 40, 50 reasons that are all valid about why people stay in these situations, I then said, but this is the wrong question and this is the wrong focus. And so while it's important that I was able to highlight all, again, the very salient reasons that people stay, and sometimes for their own safety or the safety of their children, and they think leaving is going to leave them without anything, etc., let's not just stop with that question. That can be one question among many. Like, let's understand the kind of personality that puts someone in a situation that makes them feel they have no choice but to stay in a bad situation. Let's focus on that person. Let's focus on the person who put someone in a situation where they felt like they had to stay being abused or neglected because that was the better choice somehow. That takes a lot of manipulation. Let's learn about that. Let's learn about that personality, that disorder. And then we'll understand what their victims were put through and why they stayed by default. There is something also really interesting about learning about these personalities of people who will, as Peter talked about, have an enduring pattern of maladaptive behaviors across a lifetime. And what do we learn about them? What do we know about them? That they are grandiose, that they lack empathy. And as Peter said, and I love this phrase, they have arrogance that's not earned, which is beautiful. And it's true. They just assume it. They have the righteous indignation, or as I call them, the how dare yous. But I think that there is something really interesting when you are suddenly faced with this personality, when you realize that for a lot of them, they have this intentionality. They might have a disorder, but as part of it, or just their personality, they want to take someone away from their ability to feel confident in themselves. They want to take someone away from their community so that they're isolated. They want to hurt them and see what kind of reaction they get, and if they can get a big reaction and that feels satisfying. There is something chilling when you realize that someone could be doing something to you on purpose. We want to give people the benefit of the doubt. We want to give them an out. We want to not know there are people who are among us who would just do this for sport, who would do this for satisfaction. But they exist, and it's important to know that they exist. And that even if we diagnose someone with something because of that, they still need to take responsibility for what they are doing to others through their own knowledge and without the other person's knowledge or consent. I remember when Peter was talking about being idealized and then discarded, this previous relationship that I sometimes go back to, where I was really puffed up at the beginning. Oh, you're the most wonderful, everything. And it feels nice. And you feel like this person is choosing you, who could choose anyone because, you know, you see them as someone so wonderful, but that they see you as incredibly wonderful until they don't. And when they don't, you not only kind of matter less, you get the impression that you don't matter at all. And the stark contrast is like whiplash. I remember being complimented so often, and it felt good. It wasn't necessary for me, for my personality, but it felt really good. But as soon as this person was done with me, I remember I was just suddenly told that I needed to leave. They were done. I needed to move out. And that was it. And just a few weeks later, after I did find another place to live, because it was so awful staying there once this person was done with me, I was told actually to stop by and pick up some of the things that I had left at the house, and was handed a piece of paper with the address on it. And I said, "What is this?" And they said, "Oh, this is the address where you have your things." I said, "You're handing me the address where I lived with you for a few years?" Oh, right. I forgot. I thought you just left your stuff. Right. No. We live together. Yeah. I guess you don't need this. And I thought, wow, to be so devalued, so forgotten about, this person has so moved on, and then they don't remember you lived there, and they're going to hand you your address. What is that? And who does that? And to have this cutoff that is so severe, it's like when growing up in California, we'd sometimes go to the ocean and you learned that you would only go out so far where you could feel the sand underneath you as you went into the water. And at some point there would be a drop off. And I hated that. People who like to go deep sea diving, they love the drop off because that's where things get exciting. For me, that's where they get terrifying. And the ground suddenly falls out from beneath you and there's nothing there. And that's how it felt to me in that moment on so many levels, this sudden drop off that the earth is not underneath you. You deserve better. You deserve consistency. You deserve to be with someone healthy. That's something I needed to convince myself of. And I'm hoping to convince you of it too. Thank you to Dr. Salerno for his work, for his insights, for sharing his experience and all that he has learned over these years of doing really wonderful work and great education. Talk to you all next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.